Well, here's a vision for our times. The Son of Man will send his angels, and they will collect out of his kingdom all causes of sin and all evildoers, and they will throw them into the furnace of fire. Oof. Now, you can fill in those categories, causes of sin and evildoers, in whatever way you want, but still, this is a story with a punch, isn't it? On the 4th of July, we finally got around here in the Paul household to burning our Christmas tree, a 13-foot giant that had graced our greenhouse, and that I dragged out of there and down the hill to our fire pit around Valentine's Day, I think it was. It made a great blaze, 20 feet up into the air, crackling and hot. And as it started to die down a little bit, I added the tree that I had bought from our church sale, which had been in our family room. Whoosh! So this image of weeds and causes of sin and evildoers crackling in the furnace of fire is a vivid one, isn't it? But here's the point. It's an image. It's a story. What we have in our gospel for today is a rhetorical vision of apocalyptic justice. Of God burning up what is gross, what is gross, what is holding back our flourishing in a crackling blaze of justice. The image is designed to motivate us to action. It's an image to encourage Jesus's listeners, workers, farmers, peasants, slaves, not to get stuck in the weeds of life. It's a tragedy that so many have rendered this image literal and thereby missed its truth as rhetorical metaphor and apocalyptic image. We won't repeat that mistake here. This is not a description of what happens to anyone for eternity. This is an image of the end of the age when God's kingdom is all in all, when justice and peace prevail and all causes of sin have passed away. May it be so. And then, when the weeds are cleared away after the harvest, then we can see with our ancestor Jacob that ladder coming down from heaven through a beautiful gate, with the angels coming down to us with the promise direct from God, not a threat, a promise of flourishing and growth and continuity and ancestors and abundance, even in a time of the fire of plague. May that be so too. So let me start to unpack these wonderful stories briefly with a question. Gardeners out there, what's your favorite weed? Okay, that is a loaded question, I know. And I don't mean it to be an invitation to confession, although, of course, I'm always willing to listen as necessary. But I mean it seriously. What's your favorite weed? The type that grows in your garden or lawn and that you feel compelled to dig out, pull up, get rid of. To understand Jesus' message in today's gospel, I think we have to recognize how our lives are invariably interconnected with weeds, literal and metaphorical. And I don't want you to think of these weeds as enemies. Not yet. Although I know this is hard, because when they're choking off your carrots, it's hard not to dislike the little creatures. But I think the final wisdom of our gospel reading for today orients us to the fact that these weeds, literal and metaphorical, are creatures of God, like us. answerable to God, like us. And so I want us to think today about God's weeds. I want us to meditate together on how even the thorny and twisted and tangled aspects of life might work together for good. My favorite weed is the dandelion. I know that puts me in a decided minority, and I think I've shared with the church before that one of my favorite children's messages in the spring is to bring a dandelion into the church, hold it up, and ask children a very simple question. What is this? Invariably, a little girl or boy will say, "A flower," and then I'm on my way. They are beautiful, seen in the right light. They are certainly resilient. And they are a food group. Their greens are great in salads, and they can make fine wine. Well, okay, they can make nasty wine, but still. And I want to get us thinking differently about weeds as creatures of God, because the fact of the matter is that weeds we dislike take root, so to speak, in things we love. The weeds of resentment, envy, coveting, greed, lying, fear grow in the same soil as our loves, and they draw from the same nutrients. I'll highlight three in our brief time together today: the weeds of resentment, lying, and fear. Resentment is, according to Friedrich Nietzsche, the characteristic emotion or behavioral attitude of Christians. I don't completely agree with Nietzsche, but my 60-plus years of interactions with Christians lead me to believe that he was onto something. Alas. Practically, resentment manifests itself in lots of passive-aggressive behavior and in a subtle sense or feeling that someone somewhere is getting away with something that I, by rights, deserve. That new car, or job, or house, or heaven, or what have you. Resentment is the sense, often inaccurate, but felt, of having been wronged by some enemy. Or even worse, by a friend who has now betrayed you. But as Nietzsche saw it, in any event, resentment is a poor substitute for acting on any injustice. Resentment is the mud in which we wallow while they, whoever they are, dance in the sunflowers. Nietzsche tied resentment especially to Christ's crucifixion, which generated, he thought, a slave mentality, obedience to God in Christians. On that point, I think he was simply wrong. Christians have been pretty active in history for justice, but that's a longer argument for another day. There's little doubt, however, that the weed of resentment is deep in American culture right now. It's exacerbated, I think, by democracy. When we have an open society where we know how others live, that knowledge can stoke rivalries that can be exploited by demagogues. Think Facebook. And to be clear, resentment is found on both the left and the right. On the right, resentment is often manifest in victim mentality. No matter how privileged a person might be, whatever problem exists can be directed at an unjustly elevated other. They are getting what I should have or used to have or imagine that my kind used to have. And on the left, resentment tends to manifest in condescending pull-down practices, in putting people down for their accomplishments, finding the underside of everybody, pointing out that, no, that dandelion isn't a flower, it's a weed. But what's interesting to me, and why resentment is finally one of God's weeds too, is to recognize that resentment flows from desire. One of Nietzsche's commentators, Robert Solomon, thought that resentment was the frustrated desire to take revenge for a blow to one's self-esteem. That's not too far off. The point is this: resentment is a slightly twisted version of the desire to be loved, manifest in the fear that one might not be loved. So the cure for this one of God's weeds? Nothing toxic. Certainly not a theological equivalent of the herbicide Roundup, which you may have heard. Bayer will pay $10 billion in damages for circulating such a toxic carcinogen. No, the cure for resentment is not more toxicity, but more love. So let that resentment grow. And maybe the wheat of love will grow right up alongside it. And when we harvest that wheat, then the weed can go. Or take the weed of lying. I must confess that as a child, I was a frequent liar. It drove my parents, who may be joining us today, more than a little crazy. And it puzzled me too. I didn't like lying, and I wasn't even sure why I did it, but I saw recently a study which found that a child who lies is just doing what children do. Testing where the boundaries are, learning to negotiate the differences between truth and falsehood. May not be the best method of learning, can't say I recommend it, but it is not necessarily a sign of malice or a symptom of some deep disorder. Parents, you may be happy to hear this. Indeed, lying by a child may be a sign of intelligence and creativity, this study said. So let that weed grow. But among adults, those of us who have presumably learned to distinguish truth from falsehood, lying is one of those weeds that's hard to place in God's hands, isn't it? The Swedish philosopher Sissela Bach, in her important book from the late 70s, still being used, Lying, Moral Choice in Private and Public Life, defined lying as a statement believed by the liar to be false, made to another person with the intention that the person be deceived by the statement. Lying is wrong because it violates the rules of fair play, our sense of equity. The liar imagines himself to be special, capable of breaking the trust upon which society depends. A lie thus depends upon other people counting on the fact that you're telling the truth. Because who wants to be lied to? Everyone is tempted to lie, but who wants to be the dupe? Who falls for the lie? Lying, in other words, depends upon what Bach calls the principle of veracity, a very strong, almost absolute presumption against lying. And here's where we see again how weeds grow in the same soil as wheat. We need truth-telling to live together, but truth-telling only works when we trust that the words being used are trustworthy. When truth-telling is repeatedly violated, everything seems up for grabs, doesn't it? It's a real problem these days, right? Don't you feel that? We trust that people will tell the truth, and when the principle of veracity is violated, the very category of truth itself may come into question. Even though we know when we are honest with ourselves that there is a truth that is violated by any lie. So what do we do with this weed? How is this one of God's creations? Well, let's say that if we didn't know or experience the pain of absence, if everyone was constantly present to one another and with one another perpetually, what kind of world would that be? I know, it sounds like a science fiction plot or something that might follow from a stay-at-home order, but please stay with me. How could we experience the pleasure of presence without the pain of absence? The absence of the truth in the form of a lie or repeated lies may be a catalyst to stoke a renewed commitment to the truth. A lie, or many of them, might be a way for us to take a heartier stand for truth and for trust, as opposed to manipulation, scheming, lying. I know as a child that I learned to tell the truth by learning to realize the consequences of falsehood, the pain, suffering, uncertainty, anxiety, unhappiness, fear. I trust that you follow the thread of my thought. Oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive. Which is not, as I once learned, Shakespeare, but only Sir Walter Scott. Still, the point's a good one. The remedy for the deception of lying, then, is stronger and more robust truth-telling, more wheat. We let the lies linger. Just let them lie there, and they will, in due course, serve as fertilizer, the very soil out of which the beautiful flower of truth can spring. After all, those weeds of lies, when they burn, become carbon, right? Out of which all life springs. And underneath all of God's weeds, greed, despair, anxiety, anger, and so many more, is the weed of fear. Fear tends to manifest in an us-them dualism. We assert our superiority, competence, intelligence, excellence over them to cover up our fear of inferiority, incompetence, stupidity, mediocrity. Dualism. Take the case of white supremacy. James Baldwin in The Fire Next Time, which a small group of us have been reading and discussing together, discusses how fear of another, the fear at the root of racism, invariably resolves to fear of oneself. Baldwin gets to this conclusion by talking about gospel music and jazz. And no, I'm not making this up. In gospel and jazz, Baldwin writes, there is, quote, something tart and ironic, authoritative and double-edged. A blues might have some happiness and hope in it, and a jump or a swing tune might be profoundly sad or even tragic. In blues and jazz, and often in the black church in my experience, I worshiped in one for my last 5 years in Philadelphia, usually the only person of European descent in the congregation on Sunday. In the black church, often, critique and hope coexist. In African-American experience at its best, largely because of the weed of racism, dualisms give way to paradoxes. A sinner and a saint inhabits the same soul. Grace and works harmonize. Ancestors from the past and descendants in the future exist in a fertile, fermenting present. Weeds and wheat are both real. Salvation and the quest for justice are part of the same tenacious struggle. Such resistance to conventional dualisms, such resistance in the form of syncopation and dissonance and paradoxes, harmonies of sevenths and ninths and elevenths and thirteenths and sixteenth note triplets and 5/4 time that resolve themselves eventually or not, such transformations and changes are at the heart of jazz. White Americans, Baldwin goes on, generally, and I'm quoting, do not understand the depths out of which such an ironic tenacity comes, but they suspect that the force is sensual, and they are terrified of sensuality and do not any longer understand it. End quote. Now, to talk about the racism stemming from a fear of sensuality is to tread on delicate ground, raising the specter of stereotype, which Baldwin is quick to dismiss. And James Baldwin then goes on to explain that, quote, "To be sensual, I think, is to respect and rejoice in the force of life itself, and to be present in all that one does, from the effort of loving to the breaking of bread," end quote. That is as beautiful a definition of what it means to be anti-racist as I can imagine. To respect and rejoice in the force of life itself, and to be present in all that one does, from the effort of loving to the breaking of bread. Let's start there. But of course, Baldwin goes on, because the hope and critique mutually reinforce each other. Something very sinister, Baldwin writes, and I'm going to quote him at length now. Something very sinister happens to the people of a country when they begin to distrust their own reactions as deeply as they do here and become as joyless as they have become. It is this individual uncertainty on the part of white American men and women, this inability to renew themselves at the foundation of their own lives, that makes the discussion, let alone elucidation of any conundrum, that is, any reality, to be extremely difficult. The person who distrusts oneself has no touchstone for reality, for this touchstone can be only oneself. Such a person interposes between oneself and reality nothing less than a labyrinth of attitudes, call them weeds. And these attitudes, furthermore, though the person is usually unaware of it, is unaware of so much, are historical and public attitudes. They do not relate to the present any more than they relate to the person. Therefore, whatever white people do not know about blacks reveals precisely and inexorably what they do not know about themselves. End quote. In other words, our fears reflect our tendency to project our fragility outwards in conventional attitudes or prejudices or stereotypes. We project our fragility outward, distancing ourselves from it, rather than really being present to each other in all of our fragility. Distrust of one another. And what is racism but distrust linked with power? Distrust of another resolves to distrust of oneself, calling Socrates or calling Jesus. So how to deal with the weed of fear? Burn it up in the fire of justice. How to resist the weed of fear? Turn it over into courage, to love. How to transform fear into love? Pay attention to the wheat, which always grows right up along with the weeds, unless we decide to dump some toxic herbicide into the earth. Any weed takes root in the same soil of the sensuous yes to life that was God's first word in creation. It is good. And that can be, must be, again, our word to all of life. in all of its diversity and delight, as we learn from our African-American sisters and brothers over the next year, learn to be anti-racists. So let's learn to live with these weeds, right? And let's grow some wheat. Call it the Jacob's Ladder hybrid. What's truly beautiful about the story of Jacob's dream is that in it, God, through God's angels, God's messengers, climbs down to help Jacob flourish and grow. It's the same for us. This is the source of every good dream. It's not that we have to climb up the ladder, which has been an unfortunate interpretation of this story that has become commonplace, one of those conventions. But that's not what the story says. We are climbing Jacob's ladder is a great hymn, and we're going to sing it. But one version of its lyrics get the story exactly backwards. God climbs down Jacob's ladder first to us. And then we, those weeds, can climb up. The promise is as breathtaking and stunning as can be. All the families of the earth shall be blessed in you and in your offspring. Now that's something to live for. All the families of the earth shall be blessed in you and your offspring. Do we believe it? Or do we distrust ourselves, distrust our God, distrust others? Is that any way to live? Imagine with me then how we might put that blessing into practice when we practice trust. Union's faithful have done extraordinary things in our history, and now we have some unique challenges before us. Now we can build on the momentum of the Green Gospel and help work with other people of faith and public officials to put in place policies that care for the planet and sustain this beautiful earth that God has created. Now we can learn new ways to be church as we protect each other during this pandemic and as we demonstrating to a doubtful and fearful and resentful and in some cases lying world that trust in God is compatible with trusting in scientists. Now we can continue our heritage as an anti-racist church, demonstrating that love of God and love of neighbor means Black Lives Matter. Those of us who are of European American descent can be allies of our African American sisters and brothers because Jacob's story is their story too. There is no us and them in God's version, God's vision of the kingdom. And we can be bold. We'll make mistakes. Some weeds will crop up. But God's promise is this, and it is as solid as the soil on which we walk, in which we plant, from which we live. Know that I am with you and will keep you wherever you go. And will bring you back to this land. For I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. So let's embrace that promise of presence, even in this time of absence, this time of fire. Let's embrace that promise of presence in all of its wonderful earthy sensuality. And put it into practice in our individual lives, in our families, in our church, in our nation, in the world. To respect and rejoice in the force of life itself. And to be present in all that one does. From the effort of loving to the breaking of bread. Amen.